You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am your host, Brandon, and I am joined today by Hale. You are listening to our Reading the Pre-Socratics series. This is episode 3. Today we are going to be looking over the fragments and testimonia of Pythagoras and Xenophanes. Previously, in the last two episodes, we discussed and looked over the Milesian school, the first kind of continuous line of intellectual tradition that we have in ancient Greek thought, or at least recognizably philosophical. But now we are moving on the cusp of something beyond just the Milesian speculations about the natural world, about a cosmic order in terms of these classical elements. I mean, when we get to Xenophanes, we'll see that come up again a little bit. But what is really interesting about the two thinkers that we're going to be talking about today is we're finally looking at some thinkers who have gone beyond this particular Milesian project of grounding the cosmos in a, we would say something like a material arche. Anaximander's Apeiron is not exactly that, but he was trying to aim for something like a physical explanation of why things generate the way they do. Interestingly, the Pythagoreans and Xenophanes as well are trying to do that, but they're doing it in radically different ways. So first, we are going to be talking about Pythagoras, and then we'll talk about Xenophanes. I actually think that, as far as I'm aware, Pythagoras comes a little bit earlier than Xenophanes, because we have Xenophanes commenting on Pythagoreans. So that's a bit... It makes sense to start with Pythagoras. I do think that there is something to be said about maybe transitioning from the Milesians to the what we will call the Italian school through Xenophanes, but we'll start with Pythagoras because I think Pythagoras is more of the radical. In any case, we should probably introduce Pythagoras just a little bit. How does Pythagoras, like what is his history and what were his thoughts? Well, interestingly, we don't have a ton of concrete evidence. Or, well, we have some things that we know, but the thing that is synonymous with Pythagoras is that he's largely shrouded in legend and mystery. He has miracles attributed to him. He is said to have traveled all over and accrued certain ideas from Egypt. He's said to have imported the idea of the immortality of the soul from Egypt. There are even arguments made that he might have picked up ideas of like shamanism from the Mongolian nations or from Tibet. That's really interesting and kind of novel way of seeing Pythagoras. But in any case, there's so much speculation, and so much so that some scholars don't even really talk about Pythagoras as an individual thinker. They talk about Pythagoreans and Pythagoreanism as a school of philosophy or as a school of thought. And it's interesting too, because if we look at what we do know about Pythagoras, we know that Pythagoras was born on the island of Samos, which is off the Ionian coast. So far we've been focusing on the Ionian coast, which is the east of Turkey that meets the Aegean Sea. Now we're going to see Pythagoras. He's going to emigrate from Samos, and he's going to go into essentially what was called then Magna Graeca, Greater Greece, but it's the Italian peninsula. Greeks at this time were colonizing various portions of the Italian world, and Pythagoras lands in the city of Croton. And he establishes a, I guess it's a cult, but cult then probably means something a little bit different. He establishes a following, and that following came to be the Pythagoreans. And interestingly, they became politically quite relevant, and they came to dominate the political activities of that city.
I don't think there's much doubt about Pythagoras not being a real person. He almost certainly was a real guy. He came from Samos. He moved to Croton. He started a sort of pseudo, what we might call a pseudo spiritual, philosophical, religious cult movement. As our listeners will see, it had a large amount of focus on mathematics. But then beyond that, like, I've heard other scholars basically say, like, we actually don't really know anything specifically about him. Like, even a lot of the bigger things that are attributed to him, like, we'll probably get it right out of the way right off the bat, are probably most of our listeners. Funnily enough, Pythagoras is probably one of the names that most of our listeners are most familiar with because of the Pythagorean theorem.
A squared plus B squared equals C squared. So you can find the hypotenuse of a triangle by this formula if you know the other two sides.
It shows you how long ago I done that. But the important point, why it doesn't even matter whether or not I remember or not, is because, you know, that, for example, it's not even clear that he came up with that. He probably didn't. And it's getting into some of the history of Pythagoras. That's largely because Pythagoras had a really large impact on the philosophical and intellectual culture of the Mediterranean, especially the Eastern Mediterranean, long after his death. Like, we're talking Pythagoras and his followers and his movement continue to be a thing well up until the early transitional period into, you know, the mass adoption of Christianity. There's really some interesting stuff going on there. But that's like a solid almost 1,000 years after he died. You know, we've talked about this a little bit before with some of the other pre-Socratics. It's probably the most true with Pythagoras of any of them. What really we deal with as people interested in philosophy and history and such with Pythagoras is a lot of people operating in the Pythagorean school who are writing anywhere from 100 to 800-900 years after the actual guy died. And there's this loose collection, this loose evolution of philosophical ideas that we call Pythagorean, probably 99% of which are not actually attributed to or directly related to the man himself. We really are more dealing with a school, but it's important to bring it up because that school was incredibly influential in the ancient world. It was one of the main pseudo-philosophical religious movements that existed through the whole period, and it was one that had a massive influence on people like Plato, people like Aristotle, later philosophers in the Stoic period as well. And so he's, as a guy, is really important in that way because his school is so influential, even though we know almost nothing about him.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, we've got some, like, some trivia about where he comes from, but as a in terms of attributing doctrines to Pythagoras, the man, we don't have much to go on. We have lots of fragments about things that Pythagoras may have uttered as what was called acousma, these sayings that Pythagoras would have kind of just vaguely said that his followers were supposed to adopt as precepts.
There's some good ones too.
Yeah, there's some really interesting ones. We'll get into those. They're a lot of fun. They're real head scratchers. But it's interesting too because, and just to go into a bit of the way that, because I think, yeah, the Pythagoreans are really unique in that you legitimately, Pythagoras is almost set up to be difficult, if not impossible, to pin down anything to this particular thinker. You really do have to look at the movement. We have to settle ourselves for, well, what did the Pythagoreans pick up and preserve? What did later Pythagoreans think was important in this movement? And it is interesting go ahead.
I was just gonna, it's kind of exactly what you're saying, Brandon, which is an interesting point. You know, I have read multiple places that most or many scholars of this period consider Pythagoras and Socrates, unsurprisingly, to be the two most kind of influential bedrock thinkers. Funnily enough, both of them were against writing anything down. Neither of them ever wrote anything as far as we're aware, and both of them seemed to be actually antithetical to writing their work down, which makes it, you know, it's obvious with Socrates the problems there, but with Socrates, like, we had a couple of very close, well-established thinkers writing about him, characterizing him, obviously influencing him. I'm sure we've talked about it many times on the show. But, you know, you have people like Plato, obviously, and who's the other historian whose name? I want to call him Aristophanes, but that's not correct. The other guy who wrote considerably about Socrates.
There was Xenophon, but I think you're thinking Xenophon. Aristophanes, who wrote a comedy about him.
Yeah, there was a few people writing very closely in his time period about him. Pythagoras, we don't have anything like that. We have more like legends and whispers and sayings that people, again, that people wrote anywhere from decades to literally close to an eon after he died. And so he's even much more of a kind of mysterious sort of philosophical character. And they get a little bit more in the later history about him. We're not really going to cover this so much in the show, but it was something that I thought was really interesting and really shows this sort of characterization, this historical kind of evolution of the man of Pythagoras as a useful tool philosophically. Many later pagan writers used, like we're talking during the Roman period, but particularly in the second, third century, as Christianity became more and more prevalent. Obviously, they have this made guy, this miracle worker, this impressive individual, Jesus, that they're kind of propagating. I know a lot of scholars, as I was looking into it, believe that what happened with the kind of Neoplatonist movement, which had a lot of Pythagorean stuff going on, was that Pythagoras kind of became the Jesus stand-in, basically. He was, you know, always written as this hyper-ethical, you know, value-laden guy who also often had, like, you know, miracles attributed to him. And so you see in these later Roman-era writings about Pythagoras and from the school that he becomes more and more of a kind of pseudo-savior, miracle-worker type of individual, probably as a way to kind of counter Christ, basically. Right. He's like, okay, the Christians have Jesus. He's this guy. He does all stuff. Well, we actually have the same thing. He's Pythagoras. He's also a miracle worker. He's also super ethical. He's also kind of magic, like kind of a magician. Right. And he also knows the truth of the universe. I'm sure we're going to get into like what that truth looked like for the Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans, more importantly. But it's interesting that that's kind of what he became later on, especially in the later period.
Interesting. Yeah. That is, I mean, now when I think of, you know, the Jesus of philosophy, I think of Socrates because he's got a trial and all that. But that is really interesting that Pythagoras took that spot for a while.
Is there anything else we want to say about him? Because I know there's kind of a lot to talk about, you know, the info and history around him before we jump into.
Yeah. So before we jump into reading the fragments, one of the other things that I wanted to bring up in terms of like the history of the school of the Pythagoreans when you go into the scholarship, you'll hear this distinction between the akousmata and the akousmatikoi and the mathematikoi. And you can think of them as kind of the early and later school of the early Pythagoreans. So we've got the early Pythagorean school, and then you've got these later Neo-Pythagoreans, sure, but within this early Pythagorean explosion, you have the initial akousmatikoi. These are the people who listened to Pythagoras and propagated the obscure but philosophically fruitful and thought-provoking sayings that Pythagoras would have uttered. These would have been things like ethical maxims, but probably also natural propositions as well. Later on, we would have the emerging school of the mathematikoi. Now, the mathematikoi are essentially akousmatikoi, except that they think that by doing technical work in geometry and mathematics and acoustics, So one of the early interests of the Pythagoreans was acoustics and finding ratios and proportions in sound. So we have things like, we have pictures of Pythagoras and Philolaus holding and playing flutes to check their harmonies and whatnot. But later on, the Mathematicoi think that they are being more Pythagorean than the Pythagoreans because they're doubling down on this mathematical aspect of it. So the Mathematicoi become very obsessed with not just the sayings and whatnot. They sort of, they don't really abandon those. Those are the ground that they come from, but they become extremely concerned with the, what would have been at the time considered the divine elements, the, you know, the geometric elements of it.
Yeah, to spoil things a little bit and to oversimplify, the Mathematicoi and the sort of growth of the Pythagoreanism in that way really, this is going to sound kind of a little negative, but it really does turn into kind of like a numerology a little bit, right? Like it and as our listeners will see, we'll discuss some. There really does become this aspect of like, and this is a great and a really important shift for Pythagoras and this whole, the movement in general, especially the Mathematicoi, is we really transition away from figuring out the material stuff like we did with the Milesians, like what's the central material sort of pusher of the universe, transition to more the form of things, the metaphysical aspect underlying everything. And for them, it's numbers, it's mathematics, and you can kind of tease and that out and discover it.
Yeah, it becomes something that has a particular form in that sense. So I think with that out of the way, we can get into the fragments themselves now. Well, the first couple are sort of biographical, and we've covered that a little bit. So Herodotus and Porphyry give us that, according to my information from the Greeks who live beside the Hellespont and Pontus, this Salmoxis, a real man, was a slave in Samos to Pythagoras, son of Nemarchus. But I believe that this Salmoxis lived many years before Pythagoras. So this is Herodotus trying to establish the historical truth of Pythagoras.
It's really interesting, like, looking at, just as a note on the fragments and what it is to work with them or to go through them, that it's, like, for our listeners, this sort of, like, vague utterance of, like, knowing someone who was associated with the guy that we're concerned with is what's kind of left over to us as, like, a closer historical reference. Like, of all the things, like, you know, Pythagoras being one of the most, you know, influential and kind of famous ancient thinkers, one of the earliest and closest fragments we have is literally just a short writing about, hey, I know this slave, he was around, and he actually, I think, belonged to that guy that we were talking about, and that's it. So it's just interesting to see, like, just how little is actually kind of left in the period. But yeah, there's a little more, but going over, I'll always apologize to our listeners, the pronouncing of some of the ancient Greek names is difficult, but Aristoxenes says that at the age of 40, seeing the tyranny of Polycrates was too intense, he made his departure from Italy to Croton. So another, like, classic kind of, you know, early thinker aspect of, like, being against or moving away from tyranny. Right, that's what took him to Italy and away from the Ionian coast. And then, as well, 300 of the young men, the followers of Pythagoras, bound to each other by oath-like brotherhood, lived segregated from the rest of citizens as if to form a secret band of conspirators and brought the city of Croton under their control. So this is, again, referencing, like, the really early Pythagorean school. I think an interesting note of that whole line is lived segregated from the rest of the citizens. This, I think, is, like, it hints to me at an idea that becomes really influential with Plato. And I think it's worth noting that Pythagoras was, or at least the Pythagoreans, were enormously influential on Plato, especially later Platonic thought. I know I read one scholar who discussing them who basically said that, you know, the story of Plato is him transitioning from, you know, being influenced to by Socrates to being more influenced by the Pythagoreans as time went on. But there's this notion that, you know, which becomes really big with Plato, that one has to, like, remove oneself from, you know, the daily material life, right? That the isolated philosophical world or philosophical thinking, you know, entering the realm of the soul, that is how one achieves, you know, a kind of philosophical aptitude, philosophical greatness, and goes, like, beyond that. So again, that kind of notion of, like, you know, the Pythagoreans, they lived segregated from the rest of the city. They lived segregated from daily life.
Yeah. Yeah, there is much in the way of, especially later commenters on Pythagoras, they talk a lot about this unusual silence that the Pythagoreans kept amongst one another, and the very tight bond that the Pythagoreans kept their stories of Pythagorean fellow Pythagoreans basically sacrificing themselves or rewarding people for helping out other Pythagoreans in just enormous proportions. They cared very much for each other in that way.
This is the fourth fragment that we have. It goes, it's a little longer. 10 is the very nature of number. So the number 10. 10 is the very nature of number. All Greeks and all barbarians alike count up to 10, and having reached 10, revert again to the unit. And again, Pythagoras maintains the power of the number 10 lies in the number 4, the tetrad. This is the reason. If one starts at the unit and adds the successive numbers up to 4, one will make up the number 10. And if one exceeds the tetrad, one will exceed 10 too. If that is, one takes the unit, adds 2, then 3, and then 4, one will make up the number 10. So the Pythagoreans used to invoke the tetrad as their most binding oath and say, nay, by him that gave to our generation the tetrarchies, which contains the fount and root of eternal nature.
Yeah, so 10 is going to be very important. This is kind of the... If you're trying to make sense of how it is that the akousmatikoi and the mathematikoi relate to one another, it's kind of, I think it's in something like the tetrad. So the akousmatikoi get passed on this hearing that 10 is the nature of all, and then they're like, what does that mean? And then they deduce all of these things from it. But then the mathematikoi, in unpacking or unraveling this saying, find out, oh, there's actually a lot of internal relations going on inside of the number 10. So one of the other things about the tetrad that was important for the mathematikoi is that the number 10 adds up to it. Then technically the tetrad, because it also contains the number 4, the tetrarchy, which contains all of the proportions that are in harmonics. So you have the octave, 1 and 2, then 2 and 3, I'm not sure what that is called, and then 3 and 4. So 1 and 2, 2 and 3, 3 and 4. You have exhausted all the relations in harmonics there. So there is one other way that the mathematikoi see themselves in the akousma.
You know, imagine being a Pythagorean or being at this time. Obviously, it's difficult. But again, talking about this transition from the material to the form of things, the underlying reality, the metaphysical form of stuff, you can see how finding these mathematical ratios, finding these mathematical formulas, finding these mathematical patterns that exist consistently, the tetrad is a thing no matter what kind of material you're counting, right? Whether it's people, stones, cups of water, birds, whatever it's going to be, right? This always holds. And so you can see why this form structure becomes so interesting as an explanation, or at least some sort of clue to the nature of reality for the Pythagoreans. Here we found this form, we found this mathematical structure you know, as you brought up multiple times, music and understanding harmonies was a big part of that, because regardless of what kind of instrument you're playing and what kind of music, these structures hold true across the board. And so it seems obvious that there's some sort of more background structural thing going on to the nature of the universe that this kind of, these sorts of mathematical formulas are related to.
Mm-hmm. And I think the interesting thing in this is that to kind of anticipate, or even to call back to the Milesians a little bit, it's this idea that, well, it looks like the world is kind of just a jumbled slurry of whatever phenomenon we have, but actually that cosmos that everyone's talking about is real. If you actually go and look, you can see that things are not aperon, they're not chaotic, as Anaximander says. They are peros, they are limited, they are bound, they are proportionate. And check it out, if we go pluck on a string and we put the our finger halfway through it, it produces an octave higher, and if we do it 2/3, it produces I forget what the note would be called, but, and this is consistent across all strings, this is consistent across all instruments that we play. So this form, this structure, exists throughout reality. That was, and it's the idea that what we thought was just chaotic, we can make out the structure of it, we can clear the mist of reality, we can clarify the way the world is. That's what's really exciting, and I think galvanizes the Pythagoreans.
Yeah, and made, I think it's a part of the reason why, at least, that the Pythagoreanism became such a large movement in the ancient world, right? Because it does have this explanatory power that a lot of our other earlier Milesians kind of don't, right? They posit basic stuff, they give reasons, which was very philosophically interesting and important, but they're much harder to, there's something much easier to demonstrate about noting the mathematical form, structures, and consistencies that lay across all of reality as we encounter it. Going on to the next fragment here. The square of the hypotenuse of a right angle triangle is equal to the sum of the squares on the sides enclosing the right angle. If we pay any attention to those who like to recount ancient history, we may find some of them referring to this theorem of Pythagoras and saying that he sacrificed an ox in honor of his discovery. So that was the Pythagorean theorem, and a little note that, hey, it's a legend that Pythagoras came up with this. Again, there's not actually any evidence that he did. It's just as likely that a later adherent of Pythagoreanism came up with that, or it was discovered earlier, but it's been attributed to him. Moving on to the next fragment, we get into some more interesting sort of other metaphysical musings with these fragments here. On the subject of reincarnation, Xenophane bears witness to a eulogy which begins, "Now I will turn to another tale and show the way." What he says about the Pythagoras runs thus: "Once they say that he was passing by when a puppy was being whipped, and he took pity and said, 'Stop, do not beat it, for it is the soul of a friend that I recognize when I heard it giving tongue.'" So that's a little bit of a funny anecdote. You know, Pythagoras is walking along, here's someone abusing a puppy, apparently. Not that funny, but, you know. And says, "Hey, I recognize when I heard it giving tongue, I recognize his voice." And what that's referencing is the Pythagoreans' strong association, basically, with the transmigration of the soul, with, another way of putting it, is with reincarnation. It seems pretty consistently that Pythagoreanism had a strong inclination towards some kind of reincarnation. So, you know, the shifting of the soul after death from one type of living being to another. And, you know, as we've talked about before so far in the series, but different than Pythagoreans, there's a real emphasis on cycles. And so as far as we know, that there's a cycle, right, where, you know, the soul jumps from one being to another, to another, to another, and eventually comes back around to being a human and cycles back through. And this is a really, like, kind of